This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll hear from Baton Rouge Symphony conductor Tim Muffet. Major performance coming this Thursday at the Raising Cane's River Center. We'll talk with Maestro Muffet about this, as well as what's going on for the rest of the season. And he has been in charge longer than any other symphony conductor in Baton Rouge, going on almost two decades. Former Louisiana Budget Director Steve Wenham will be here to discuss the budget chaos at the Capitol with a special legislative session starting today, and the governor making an address this afternoon to lawmakers in hopes of averting the fiscal cliff that will come July 1st unless something is done. And author Mark Lipton, on his book, Mean Men, Mark Lipton says there is a troubling psychology behind some of America's most famous men. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. We'll have a special session of the legislature starting later today, and in just a bit we'll hear from former budget director Steve Wenham. We start with Tim Muffet, the longest-serving conductor in the history of the Baton Rouge Symphony. And this is a big week for the symphony orchestra in our community. And if you'd like to join the conversation, your number's 877-217-5757. And if you're in Baton Rouge, you can dial locally 297-5633. We welcome emails at talk@talklouisiana.org. Tim Muffet's been the conductor since 1999, so that's 19 years. Also the conductor of the Lansing Symphony since 2006. You're a man on the move, aren't you, Tim Muffet?
On the move, yes.
On the move, and quite often you take other gigs, too.
When they can be fit in, yes. That's rare, but that happens.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. I was reading about Tim Muffet in Los Angeles because you had an engagement there a few years back.
Yeah, I've had a few engagements out in California. I was at the Hollywood Bowl. That was, of course, very exciting. And I've also conducted the Long Beach Symphony and conducted the San Francisco Symphony. California is a lovely place.
And those are great entities.
Very much so, yes.
And before we get into the topic at hand, as far as the musicians that are in the Baton Rouge Symphony, you've commented, and I don't think you're just blowing smoke, they're some of the best in the world.
We have an extraordinary talent pool in our orchestra. And that's why we're able to do the things that we can do. That's why we can attract the artists that we attract. That's why we've been recognized by national institutions for our excellence. And it's all because of the great players that make up our orchestra.
You were associate conductor in Austin before mm-hmm. coming here. You've had actually two iterations in Baton Rouge, I think.
Right, yes. Yeah. I was on the faculty at the University at LSU from 1988 to 1992. I conducted the orchestra there. And then went over to Austin, Texas for 7 years. And when this position opened up, I, of course, became really familiar with the Baton Rouge Symphony when I was living here on the faculty at the university. And then when the position of music director opened up, I jumped at that. That was just very exciting. I love this community. It's where all my friends are. Mm-hmm. It's where my daughter was born. It's home to me.
And your daughter will soon be attending?
LSU, yes. I'm really excited about that.
Very good.
She had her choice of many places, and but she will be here in Baton Rouge at LSU in the fall.
Okay. Well, this Thursday, it's showtime for the symphony Thursday night, which is the tradition, 7:30 at the Raising Cane's River Center, RC Squared. Mm-hmm. And you've got an event that I know you're quite enthused about.
Well, this is a truly big night. Of course, we try to make every concert a big night, but there are some pieces of music that carry a great deal of recognition and a great deal of weight with our potential audience members, and that's the case here. We've got Carl Orff's great oratorio, Carmina Burana, and I know that every one of your listeners would recognize sections of this music because it's been co-opted in commercials and movies and TV shows, and it's immensely famous and engaging music. Going to feature our Baton Rouge Symphony Chorus. We have soloists, we have the orchestra, we have a children's chorus. It's a remarkable spectacle and production.
Outstanding. And this one is one that it obviously takes a little time to get ready for. You've been working to get this to be a very good spectacle for some weeks now, haven't you?
Well, of course, the planning has been in place for about a year and a half. Rehearsals, the chorus has been rehearsing for some time now to get ready, and I'll see the orchestra tonight, and we'll start putting things together.
Tonight?
Mm-hmm.
So you go into like the wee hours of the morning, or do you
No. We have strict limits. Yeah.
And Tim Muffett is a very physical conductor, and he always looks impeccable on stage, in part because he stays in shape, and in part because of our friend Manuel Martinez.
Yeah, Manuel keeps us looking good here in Baton Rouge.
He does indeed.
For sure.
Now, Manuel says he's dressing the governor on occasion. We'll have to ask the governor about that on his radio show later.
We'll compare notes.
Yeah, but yes. He does what he does very well, as do you. One of these treasures in Baton Rouge, and you've had opportunities. You do work in Lansing, where you have a history as well. But you left Austin, Texas. Not many people, unfortunately, not many people leave Austin to come to Baton Rouge, but you did.
I did. It was entirely because of the organization, because of the Baton Rouge Symphony, its rich history, because the Baton Rouge Symphony has a remarkable connection with its community here, and I love this place too. So I was anxious to get back. I wasn't born in Louisiana, but I got here as fast as I could.
Okay, I've got a couple of questions for you already.
Sure.
Talk at talklouisiana.org, and you can call again 877-217-5757. This is the first one. This was a rather easy one from our friend Kelly Hurtado, saying, "Good morning, Tim and Jim." It says, "What is the program the first half for the upcoming Pennington Great Performers and Concert Series featuring Chicago?"
Yeah, this is exciting. So we have the band Chicago. I want to clarify that because there's also a musical, a great musical.
But this is Chicago.
This is the band. This is the band Chicago.
25 or 6 to 4,
that's
right?
That's the one, yeah. Saturday
Make
in the
Park.
Make
me smile, yeah. Make me smile, yeah.
I mean, it's so the program is all Chicago. There is no, it's all Chicago as far as we understand. And we're just so excited to have them here. And again, the Pennington Foundation has just done an extraordinary thing for our community to make it possible to bring this group in. We're very excited.
Okay, and it's the 16th of March.
16th of March, right, not far away.
So it'll be Friday before St. Patrick's Day, so you can wear your green to see
Big
Chicago.
Weekend.
Now, this one's a little more difficult. This one is from Charlotte asking, you have supporters of the symphony from various political sides. How do you keep everybody happy?
Well, usually... Oh, that's great to know we are keeping everybody happy. I like that. Usually the arts live outside of the political world. There are certainly many cases where artists have taken political stances on things. Most of the musicians that we might present, if they were taking a political stance, let's say Shostakovich was one of the great examples, who was in a long-time battle with the Stalinist government, Those politics are history now, so we don't have to deal with it quite on the visceral edge of today's political world. And then we just try to keep. I think the arts and especially the performing arts are a place to escape the circus of politics, and so we try to keep it a safe place for all sides.
So it is a circus. Sometimes more of a circus than others, but in a community like this, obviously there are people who have strong feelings on both sides, and you're right, this should be an oasis from that kind of stuff. But
yes,
but nonetheless, you could make some comment or a joke, and it might offend somebody. So you have to.
And I'll never do that.
Fred,
I mean, in all seriousness, I think it's really very important that. That the arts remain the oasis that you mentioned, and we want everyone to feel like this is a place they can come for enrichment, for inspiration, for enlightenment, and just come and get away from it all.
Okay, and we've got some listeners
Great
who are
question,
little devilish here, saying here's one from Tracy asking how the new tax bill will affect nonprofits.
Well, of course, that's a point of concern, and there are two ways of looking at this, as one might imagine. There's one side that says that people are going to support the arts regardless of the tax incentive, and we certainly hope that is the case. And then there's the other side that says without the tax incentive, there will be less support. So we'll just have to wait and see. I do feel like in our community here, the arts are so important, and our philanthropic entities, including not only the big ones but also individuals, recognize that living in a great mm-hmm. city means having a great arts scene, and great arts organizations are expensive, and so they step up to the plate and keep it going.
Another listener wants to know the number of people in your orchestra who are from Louisiana State University. I would imagine many are.
Yes, many have a connection there. Either they've gone
some
to
for many
there.
Years.
Yes,
many,
right.
You've got some people who've been with you from day one, right?
We have faculty members from LSU. We have some very gifted students from LSU that play with us from time to time. We certainly have many alumni that play with us. And we also have people from Southern University, and we have people from Southeastern. And so many of the people that make up that are part of the area, all mm-hmm. of the area university communities make up the pool of freelance talent that are the professional musicians of the Baton Rouge Symphony.
We're going to visit a bit more with Tim Muffett, the maestro of the Baton Rouge Symphony. Thursday night, he'll be on stage for a major spectacle at the River Center. Man from Bridgeport, Connecticut, began his musical studies at the age of 7.
Oh,
we'll talk with him some more about then and now. And also, we're slated to visit with Steve Wenham, former budget director, after this pause on 89.3 WRKM. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number. Ali Baltazar is producing. In just a bit, Steve Wenham, former budget director, with a special session looming as in later today. But we're continuing for a few more minutes with Tim Muffett, the maestro of the Baton Rouge Symphony since 1999. And Thursday night at the River Center, it's Carmina Burana, a rollicking audience favorite. It says, based on the forbidden themes of the poetry laced with death, lust, gambling, and paganism.
Yes.
That's
this is why it's so popular.
Those are fun topics.
Well, the story behind this music, it's from a 13th century manuscript that had been left in a monastery and discovered. And then when Karl Orff happened to come across it in a library, it had made its way from the monastery to a library, and the composer, Karl Orff, came across this work, and immediately he knew that this was going to be a great piece of music. And the first words are, O Fortuna, fortune. Mm-hmm. And so this is, a lot of it deals with luck and fortune and misfortune, but then there also is love, and there's a section in the tavern that's rather rollicking and gambling and all kinds of exciting sides of the human species.
Well, it should be quite a 2 hours come Thursday, 7:30, River Center. You can go to brso.org, if you're interested in attending. And, of course, you survive on the benevolence of the community and their interest in the symphony. And I mentioned some of the artists who have been around for a long time. Some of the same, when I go, I see some of the same people who've been there since the first time I ever went to a symphony
performance. You bet. And that's important in an organization like this. That's how we build our culture. That's how mm-hmm. we develop our unique sound and our unique way of playing. Not only infusion of new and fresh talent from time mm-hmm. to time, but then you also have those that are sustaining our traditions.
You were in New York when you first started playing the piano, right?
That would at that point I was in Michigan.
Michigan
was in piano, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Mm-hmm. So you started at 7. If you had not done that, what would you have done for a living?
For a living, that. Oh wow, Jim. I have many interests. I mean, I enjoy growing things. I really enjoy gardening, and I enjoy travel. I could have been a long haul. Semi driver. That would have been an interesting career.
Well, you know, some people have multiple talents.
Right.
For example, our president said that he was the best baseball player in New York City in 1962. Mm-hmm. He might have been Mickey Mantle if he hadn't been president of the United States.
Well, there you go.
But you might have been one of the great gardeners in the world if you had not been the maestro of the symphony. But we're glad that for the last 19 years you've been head of the symphony, and look forward to a 20th anniversary celebration coming soon.
Coming up soon, yes.
But Thursday night, February 22nd, this Thursday, it'll be at the River Center, the usual arena, and it is a fantastic performance of one that I can tell the maestro is juiced up about.
Oh, you bet.
So if you are into the work of Tim and his musicians, this is it. Carmina Burana. And the 16th of March, Chicago.
Chicago, how about that? Yes.
Chicago.
Right. Those that program is sold out, but we have a great alternative on March 8th. You can come hear some Beethoven and some Stravinsky. Our second, our next Masterworks program is on March 8th, and we'd love to have your listeners
there
for that. I'm
sure we'll talk again soon.
Hope so.
And this afternoon, Governor John Bel Edwards hopes to hit all the right notes as he starts a special session of the legislature trying to coax lawmakers into coming up with some kind of a plan that will alleviate this fiscal cliff, a billion-dollar budget shortfall that is coming. Steve Wynum, former budget director, is with us. Steve, you can get a little closer. What are your thoughts about the task facing the governor and the legislature?
Well, I guess if I had to use one word for the way I look at the whole situation, it would be disgust, because the governor has not proposed a complete package to solve the problem. The legislature hasn't either, and so we're kind of at a stalemate, and I wish I could be more confident about the outcome of this session, but I'm not confident at all, frankly.
So if nothing happens this time around, there still is time to address it later, but time will be quite precious.
Well, sure, and I mean, we've been in limbo now for what I would say is 10 years, and we will remain in limbo if this session is unsuccessful. We will remain in limbo until June. People can't plan for next year until they know what's going to happen. Business can't plan for the foreseeable future because they don't know what their taxes are going to be. So, you know, we're in a really horrible mess. We really are.
You were here with the Romer administration, which arguably inherited an even bigger challenge than Governor Edwards did, but it was tough then, it's tough now. And then you got the legislature to go along with a plan. It went before the voters of Louisiana, and they promptly shot it down. So how difficult is it to get something done that amounts to a sweeping reform?
Well, I think that Governor Romer, as you point out, he proposed sweeping changes that were defeated, and so by default, we actually went to something that we might think that Governor Edwin Edwards would have, you know, preferred, which is gaming. Governor Edwards proposed a high-class casino in New Orleans, which always made sense to me, but we wound up with every kind of gaming you can imagine as a result of not being able to pass progressive taxes.
So you basically had to go for the low-hanging fruit.
Yes.
And the governor, as much as he says he doesn't want to do it, if they don't do anything, then that one-penny sales tax looks a lot more appealing than it did at one time.
Yeah, and that's probably the worst option. If I were to suggest how to fix the revenue side of it, I would do something really simple, which is simply eliminate the federal deduction on state income taxes, because you're talking about $1.045 billion under the old base, but with the federal changes, it's estimated that that'll go down by, say, $236 million. So let's say it's $245 million. You've still got $800 million in revenue to replace that fifth penny of the sales tax.
Well, it's something the governor might very well go along with, but that doesn't sound like a plan that the Republican majority in the legislature would agree with.
No, it doesn't. And my representative, Kenny Havard, has proposed some variations on our current sales tax base. So I would say that if we have to go to sales taxes, the kind of thing that he's talking about makes more sense than what we've got right now, which is essentially eliminate the fifth penny and broaden the base on the other four.
Now, Kenny Havard was quoted a few weeks ago in a story by Tyler Bridges of The Advocate as saying that his colleagues, his Republican cohorts, did not want to do anything to make Governor Edwards look good. This
right.
has a political element to it.
And that's another similarity between this administration and the Romer administration. You know, when Governor Romer took office, he was confronted with a legislature composed of many Edwin Edwards supporters, and they didn't want to see him succeed. Governor Edwards faces re-election in 2019, and his Republican opposition wants nothing more than a Republican governor. And so it's not, you know, obviously not the Republicans' advantage for Governor Edwards.
And when you say 2019, Steve, I've fallen into the same trap. 2019 is next year.
Yes.
So we're looking at a governor's election 20 months away. And so this is a time when the governor, if he comes out of this with a plan that the legislature agrees on, then he could look very good. And if he doesn't come out of it with something, he could look very bad. And I'm sure there are many who are keeping score.
Yes, for sure.
877-217-5757, Governor John Bel Edwards, who's now 25 months and 8 days into his term, is trying to find a plan that's palatable to avert this so-called fiscal cliff of $1 billion that is slated to happen on the 1st of July when the new fiscal year begins. We're going to talk more with Steve Wenham, former budget director under Governor Charles Elson Buddy Romer III. And Governor Romer had a plan, and he got the legislature to go along with it, but the voters of the state didn't go along with it. And as a result, Buddy Romer did what John Bel Edwards is doing. He scrambled to the finish line. We'll talk about it when we return after this news break on WRKL. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Hope you had a great weekend. 877-217-5757 is your number. You can send us an email at talk@talklouisiana.org. Ali Baltazar is producing, and Steve Wenham, former state budget director, is with us, and he's watching the dollars and cents as lawmakers convene for a special session. It costs taxpayers about $60,000 a day when they do this. And there's some ideas that are being circulated. One would reduce some of the tax exemptions. Others would include a tax on business utilities, perhaps a tax on ballet tickets, on zoo tickets. They've got to find a way to get $1 billion, and nobody wants to tax, but unfortunately, we have to pay taxes to sustain our government. And Steve Wenham, this is an age-old debate. A former treasurer, a guy we know well, John Kennedy, who's now a U.S. senator and may very well be running for governor next year, he says we could resolve this by cutting the budget. Is that palatable?
No. The numbers just simply don't work. You know, we talk about dedications and freeing up dedications, but it's not just the statutory dedications. The Constitution, you know, we only have general fund of $9.5 billion. The Constitution dedicates about $4 billion of that. So you've got, because you've got the MFP, and you know, nobody's going to cut funding for elementary and secondary education. You got $416 million in general obligation bond debt that is not appropriated, but it's a first call on the Treasury. So you put those two together, and you're up to $4 billion that's, you know, that you're not going to touch. So that's about 43% of the general fund. And then when you couple that with the other things that we pretty much have to do, we hear about two-thirds of the budget being non-discretionary. Well, I can look at those things, and some of those things I don't necessarily agree are actually non-discretionary, but constitutional requirements are definitely not discretionary expenses. And, you know, the last thing we would want to do would be to default on our general obligation bond debt.
877-217-5757. 5757 for Steve Wenham, former budget director, Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Hi, Phil. You're on the air with Steve Wenham.
Good morning, gentlemen. It seems to me we're really going in a bad direction. When if we have a 10% sales tax again, that means anything that you, you know, it just encourages people to make their purchases for big things like in another state. And then the way the internet is going, you buy things through Amazon and get shipping free and pay no taxes. I mean, sales tax doesn't seem like it's really going to work for us. I think maybe, you know, fair taxes on business.
All right. What about the sales tax? We do have the highest sales taxes in America. Some people say that's not a very good way to govern, and it puts a bigger burden on lower-income people. Your thoughts?
Yeah, and I agree. I think that sales taxes, I understand the people who say that sales taxes are the fairest taxes because they tax consumption and, you know, everybody pays them, et cetera. But as you pointed out, we all know that also sales taxes are regressive, whereas income taxes mm-hmm. are progressive. And, you know, my proposal, elimination of the federal deduction, would actually be kind of in the same spirit as the Stelly plan that was destroyed when the income tax piece of it was taken away, but the sales tax cut was left in place. Mm-hmm. So you know, I agree with Phil. We're sales taxes are not the way to go. Now, he mentioned Amazon and other online vendors. Amazon now charges sales tax, so they do on the things I buy from them. And we have a state law that says that you have to pay those taxes anyhow, whether you pay on the sales taxes or as use taxes. So that law is on the books. But a more progressive approach would be to increase income taxes and reduce sales taxes, mm-hmm. just as the Stelly plan did.
877-217-5757 if you'd like to get in before we let Steve Wenham get to following the Capitol. And there's a lot to follow as we start a special session today. Right now in the state legislature, there are 42 Democrats in the House. That's 40% of the House. And 15 in the Senate, 15 out of 39. So the governor, he starts with a very bad hand. He needs 70 votes in the House, not a majority. He needs right. 70 votes, two-thirds, and he needs 26 in the Senate, and he has to have both chambers. So it's a daunting task. So does he have his hands tied?
Yes, and, you know, the Senate, of course, has always been a more cohesive and actually, for that reason, a more powerful group, and they have probably the most effective leader in the legislature as their head, John Ilerio. Unfortunately, the House is like broken. There is not a consensus there. So if the House was more like the Senate, he'd have a much better chance than he has.
Well, the governor has a task that the president doesn't have. The president got his tax plan through with a majority vote, and he barely got that with a Republican majority. So the governor can only do so much. And some, Steve, look back to January 11th of 2016 when he proposed Walt Leger as his House Speaker, and he lost that battle.
Yes.
He's been playing, and that was even before he took the oath of office. Mm-hmm. He's been playing a very bad hand ever since.
Right, and at least Governor Romer, he still was able to pick his Speaker and his President, but, of course, about midway through his term, the Senate bucked him and reappointed Sammy Nunes as the president of the Senate, and he stayed as president of the Senate for the rest of his legislative career.
Well, Buddy Romer, when he was governor, one of his architects of the plan that the fiscal reform plan, I remember April 30th, 1989, was one none other than John Neely Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
And,
for sure.
And that one would have reduced the homestead exemption.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Nobody's talking about that now.
No, that sacred cow is safe, it would appear. And, you know, until we get a statewide property tax, it would only benefit local governments anyhow, but it would help us to transition away from our aid to local government.
Jim on Segan Lane. Jim, you're on Talk Louisiana with Steve Wenham.
Hi, gentlemen. As usual, Senator Kennedy is very good at bloviating. But as far as coming up with anything of any intelligence, that seems to usually be beyond him. The state of Kansas tried this stupidity of just cutting everything, okay? They decided they were going to make a business Field of Dreams.
All right.
Yeah, I think that Governor Brownback, if it was possible for a state to have a worse, and I hate to use the word worse, but it's the best word I can come up with, to have a worse governor than Governor Jindal, I think that they were successful there with Governor Brownback.
Well, Governor Jindal is still getting the blame for the budget situation we're in as a state. Does he deserve that?
He does, yes, because we've known about this problem. This isn't a new problem. We've known about it for at least a decade. He used temporary means to, quote, balance. In my opinion, the budget was never balanced beyond his first year in office. But he used temporary means that were sometimes not consistent with the law, in my opinion, to quote, balance the budget. But it was never really balanced for the last 7 years of his administration.
Well, when the Stelly plan was voted down, it was a coalition of Republicans and Democrats mm-hmm. that did it, including yes. one John Bel Edwards.
Right.
I would imagine Governor Edwards wishes he had the Stelly plan in place now.
Yeah, and you know, Governor Jindal, to his credit, was reluctant to do that. He didn't really want to do it. He was kind of pushed into he took out the last piece of Stelly, the last progressive piece. Blanco was also kind of forced into it in that we were flush with disaster money. And so, you know, the argument was, well, you know, we don't need this income tax increase, so let's eliminate it. And then when the disaster money ran out, we're right back in the same situation.
What do you think will happen?
Well, I think that, you know, I don't want to predetermine anything by say Betty accuses me of doing that all the time. Don't say that because it'll happen. But I don't think that anything will come of this special session other than that it will cost us $1 million. And I don't really think that we'll do a really good job in June when we have to come back in June.
Here's a question from Scott saying, doesn't the state dole out about $600 million a year in tax credits expenditures to big business? The business inventory tax credit alone is a huge subsidy that the state has to pay out to business.
Yeah, corporate taxes, if you look at the tax exemption budget of the Department of Revenue, you'll see that 91% of corporate taxes are exempt. So that which means that we don't collect 91% of the taxes that are on the books. In addition, we give various incentives to business. And I've done a lot of in working with a guy who's trying to push fiscal reform. I've done a lot of looking at the state's tax burdens on business, and you can put numbers together any way you want to, but we don't overburden businesses here.
Well, thank you for joining us. We'll be calling on you again. Steve Wynnum, appreciate your insights, former budget director. And coming next, Mark Lipton with a fascinating book, Mean Men, The Perversion of America's Self-Made Man. We'll talk more with Mark Lipton after this two-minute timeout on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana, 877-217-5757. We're joined by Mark Lipton. He's the author of Mean Men, The Perversion of America's Self-Made Man, a professor of management at the New School in New York, and he has some insights into some of the people in our country who have had great success, but who, as we know, have some personal failings, as we all do, but some more than others. And it appears that some of the most successful men, Mark Lipton, are some of the meanest guys around. How did they achieve what they've achieved being so unappealing to a lot of people around them?
Good morning, Jim. Good to be with you. Well, I think, you know, your question's a loaded one because it may depend on how do we define success and successful men. look at anyone from our president to Harvey Weinstein to Lance Armstrong to religious figures, other political figures, and are they really successful? I mean, or is success measured in a very short term and their meanness is what takes them down ultimately?
Well, already we have a question from a listener about what about mean women? If a woman is characterized as mean, it probably doesn't work as well in the workplace and beyond. Why not?
Well, I have a few responses to that. First is all the research I did starting back in 2009, it was nearly impossible to find women who fit the criteria for what really is a psychological disorder. And the proportion of women is minute compared to men. And one reason is because one of the factors that contributes to this kind of behavior is not the only one, not a significant one, but nonetheless an important one, is testosterone. And we know that women certainly have that in far lower doses. But the other piece of this is the listener raises a good point, because a lot of what's surrounding these mean men is how they express anger. And they are more likely to be angry and angry at work. And what we know from years of sociological research is that men have an advantage when they express anger. They are more highly regarded. Actually, angry men tend to be better paid than less angry men, or men who do not show that emotion. Women, it's very different. Women get punished for showing anger. And what they tend to do is internalize it. So the significantly higher rates of depression in women, both psychiatrists and sociologists now start believing it's the way in which they have to internalize anger rather than externalize it. So we could look at where are the mean women. We could look at it from a number of dimensions. It's not a simple answer, but overwhelmingly it's men.
In the old days, when a man would get angry, particularly at another man, we might have some fistic encounter. Today, we have a president. When he gets angry with somebody, he starts tweeting. The times have changed, haven't they?
Haven't they? The medium has changed by which we express this, and it's long before Twitter. When I was starting to track the academic research on how we generally communicated when email was starting, it was stunning how we don't filter ourselves nearly as well. I have to catch myself when I'm responding to somebody in email, and I realize my true emotions in that moment are starting to come out, and I have my own rule of, okay, let's keep that in draft for a while and come back to it. But I think the medium is a tailwind in expressing anger in the moment and not sitting with it and letting ourselves compose around how we process the anger. It's a really good point. Mm-hmm. So Twitter is instantaneous, getting the message, responding to the message on a visceral level. But I think we've led up to this starting with email only a couple decades ago.
Now, when we see someone like President Trump, who basically tells people exactly what he thinks of them, sometimes in the coarsest of terms, succeed as he has, and I think when you're elected president, that's a level of success that has to be recognized. What does that say to the rest of us, particularly young people who aspire to great things? Are they going to be more likely to be open about what they like or dislike about somebody?
Well, I'm moved. I'm moved by the students in Florida from that high school who are organizing. And I am moved by the directness that they are taking control of starting a movement and responding with propriety to the president and on down of people who have not taken action on policy who could have. So I would perhaps say yes to your question. And for me personally, this was a very positive thing. I was really captivated by this, wondering, 20 years ago, would high school kids have organized like this around a painful event that impacted them personally, their friends and family? So maybe we're starting to see a very positive outcome to the modeling of what Trump has done in a more negative.
The book is Mean Men, The Perversion of America's Self-Made Man by Mark Lipton. It's easy to talk about the president, but one of the titans of industry, he's now no longer with us, but his company is the number one company as far as market value, Steve Jobs. He was an eccentric who many thought was mean. You point him out in your book.
I do. And Steve Jobs, you know, there are. I don't oversimplify the complexity of mean men, and in my book, what I actually divide them up into six categories of mean. And Jobs is what I call the dogmatist. You know, he was endlessly argumentative. You know, took great delight in contradicting other people. So it just, you know, it was just getting in people's faces. And, of course, he had what became known as his reality distortion field. But nonetheless, you know, there were people drawn to him and people who revered him. And so we can look at Steve Jobs, but what I've also done is to take a look at who are the people who follow mean men like Steve Jobs, who venerate their space and do their calling. So that's just as fascinating of any type of mean men, the ones who are drawn to them because of their own deep, unresolved psychological needs, and those, like maybe the rest of us, who tend to be repelled by them.
Is this an American phenomenon, or are there mean men all over the planet?
Boy, that's a great question. I've tried to capture it as an American phenomena and understand it culturally in our country with our own institutions. I think to some extent, at least where my research and where the book started, pardon me, with looking at entrepreneurs, and we have a very unique situation, I believe, in America that's different from entrepreneurship around the world with what's known as the free agent nation. Entrepreneurs not beholden to a larger institutional body and feeling the freedom to just do what they want. But while I was engaged in some of this research, I was working alongside a psychiatrist who was looking at really horrible mean men on an international level, leaders of countries who annihilated their people. So in some respects, and in some dimensions of mean men, it's international and it's historical. What I try to focus on in mean men is more contemporary examples and more current phenomena because of how we've transitioned our organizations, and not just business, but how religion, athletics, entertainment has become far more entrepreneurially driven than it ever was. And that, I think, it's not unique to America. We're, for good or bad, we're ahead of the rest of the world in some of those shifts.
Well, the book is Mean Men, The Perversion of America's Self-Made Man. And in his book, Mark Lipton points out six types: the opportunist, the two-face, the cowboy, Mr. Dissatisfaction, the hothead, and the dogmatist. And it is a good read, and it is certainly pertinent for our times. And Mark, we only have a few seconds left, but this disordered personality that you refer to, does it affect many people, many men in America, or is this unique to only a few?
Thankfully, it's unique to a few. It's overwhelmingly a male psychopathology. And
we got to roll. But thank you, my friend, Mark Lipton. The book is Mean Men. And we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Stay tuned.
For a podcast of today's show, go to WRKF.org or find the Talk Louisiana podcast on the WRKF app. We welcome your feedback and topic suggestions. Email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Talk Louisiana is a production of WRKF in Baton Rouge.